All right, so this session and the session tomorrow morning will illuminate for you why the previous ones are important. Why it's important to have that creation model laid out, because that helps you to then be able to explain to other people, respond to the kind of quibbles that they're going to bring up against the biblical creation model. And so we're going to look at some specific examples of those kind of attacks that are being made by scientists against biblical creation, and you'll be able to see how the model that we've laid out gives us a good framework for dealing with virtually anything they can bring up. That's not to say that we have all the questions answered, but virtually anything you're going to come across, you'd be able to deal with if you really soaked up the stuff that we've been looking at here. So I like to use the Bill Nye Ken Ham debate as a good framework for giving you an example of the kind of attacks that can be made against the biblical model. So raise your hand if you saw that debate. I'm curious. Not many of you. It's been a few years, but that debate is what really launched me into, I had been dealing more with the anti-evolutionary stuff. That debate really launched me into studying making the positive case for creation, which culminated really in this material I'm presenting to you this weekend. So Bill Nye, the pseudoscience guy, went squared off against Ken Ham, who is the CEO of probably the biggest of the young earth creation organizations. And in that debate, he brought up some great points that Ken Ham really did not do a good job of dealing with, even though ironically, his website, the Answers in Genesis website, actually has most of those answers, but he apparently didn't know the stuff or what, I don't know, but it left the impression as though the biblical creation model is weak and couldn't stand up to examination, that we essentially have to just take it on blind faith that we're right. And so one of the points that he brought up, that Bill Nye, the pseudoscience guy, brought up over and over and over, that Ken Ham never dealt with. He said, so far, Mr. Ham and his worldview, the creation model, does not have this capability. It cannot make predictions and show results. The big thing I want from you, Mr. Ham, is can you come up with something that you can predict? Do you have a creation model that predicts something that will happen in nature? So this is commonly brought up against the creation model. He's not talking about predictive prophecy. He's talking about a scientific prediction where if you come up with a theory, let's say I say, okay, it is my theory that I believe that there is an invisible force that attracts smaller mass objects towards really bigger mass objects, kind of like a big magnet. Okay, so if I'm right, if my theory is right, I should be able to make a prediction and test that and see if I'm right. Okay, so if I'm right, I should be able to drop this remote and I predict that it's going to get sucked towards the Earth because the Earth is a much bigger mass. And so I can test my theory, I can make predictions and test it that'll either validate or falsify my theory. And so according to Bill Nye, the creation model doesn't have the ability to make predictions that can then go out and be examine the evidence that helps to validate your theory or falsify it. And well, hopefully you've already seen that the creation model is loaded with solid science that has great explanatory power, in fact, I've intentionally used the word prediction several times already to show you that the creation model is loaded with predictions, and clearly Bill Nye and his colleagues don't understand the biblical creation model. They haven't studied it, which is the problem really of the world around us. They haven't studied what biblical creation even involves. Otherwise, they would not make these silly kind of arguments. But I want to give you a few examples that highlight how the creation model is, in fact, scientific. It can make predictions that have been verified in nature. I have an article that's available for free on our website. I think I have free copies back there as well that respond to the Bill Nye Ken Ham debate much more in depth, including dealing with a lot of these predictions. I'm not going to have time to go through all of these in this session by any means. In fact, I'm going to jump over several of those. Again, you can look at that article. let's see. Number 11 I cover actually in a Dinosaur Day event that I do for teens, showing the archaeological, historical, and biblical evidences of the coexistence of humans and dinosaurs. And we have a book called The Dinosaur Delusion that goes into that. I also outline that in the Flooded book as well. But I want to go ahead and start with number 11. If the Earth is relatively young and humans lived alongside the dinosaurs, then we would predict that there'd be evidence that dinosaurs were around in the not too distant past, not 65 million years ago. Well, amazingly, in the last decade or so, a powerful evidence has been coming to light that the secular guys have actually come up with that is verifying this creationist prediction. Scientists have been cracking open dinosaur fossils that are supposed to be 65 to 250 million years old and discovering collagen and blood vessels with red blood cells still intact. Soft, stretchy, flexible tissue, they even have videos of this on YouTube and stuff, has been found in T-Rex, Hadrosaurs, Mosasaurs, Cetacosaurus fossils, which should have long ago decayed if these are millions of years old. Collagen and hemoglobin could last, theoretically, undecayed for thousands of years if kept cool, dry, and sterile, which is not where you find these dinosaur fossils. But you even then, even in those kind of pristine conditions, you wouldn't expect millions of years. And based on this find, it should come as no surprise that C14 is being discovered in dinosaur fossils as well. And there should be no detectable carbon-14 in any fossil that's even thought to be 50,000 years old. If you can detect carbon-14 in something, it indicates it has to be less than that because our technology doesn't allow us to find any carbon-14 in anything older than that. So this recent discovery verifies the prediction made by the creation model. We could talk more about that, but let's move on. Number 13, if the Earth is relatively young, we'd predict the geologic processes that are assumed to take eons, like petrification, we would assume that they can be found to occur rapidly in catastrophic type conditions. And sure enough, more and more scientific evidence is coming to light that verifies that prediction. Scientists have discovered that the rate of petrification can be significantly altered by catastrophic events. For example, in 2004, five Japanese scientists published their research on rapid petrification in the secular journal Sedimentary Geology. They were studying mineral-rich acidic water that was from the explosion crater of the Tateyama volcano in central Japan. Water runs over the edge of this volcano as a waterfall, and some wood had fallen in the path of this mineral-rich water, and they found the wood had petrified within 36 years. And so the scientists decided to do some more experimentation, and they found that silica petrification could occur in only 7 years. Also, back in 2004, a paper was published on rapid silicification of plants at Yellowstone, and again, there's been a flood of these kind of papers that are evidence of rapid turning of things into stone. Within 11 months in this Yellowstone paper, they found that the plants had already enough silicification that the plant tissues had become stabilized against collapse and the plant structure had been replicated. So again, modern science verifies creation model predictions. Coal, oil, and diamonds were once thought to take millions of years to form as well, but scientists now know they don't necessarily take a long time. Laboratory experiments have verified that coal can form in a matter of days, hours, even minutes, with heat being the primary requirement. Volcanic clay accelerates the process along with moderate pressure. The 1980 eruption of Mount St. Helens verifies the fact that catastrophic activity can rapidly create the environment necessary for rapid coal production. And again, the modern flood model would likely have brought about the perfect circumstances. With oil as well, scientists have discovered it doesn't necessarily take millions of years to form, as many have thought. It can be formed rapidly in laboratories, and it's even been found to form rapidly in nature. The Guaymas Basin, which is a trench in the Gulf of California, has a 1,500-foot thick layer of material deposited by billions of tiny organisms. Hot geothermal waters move through that ooze, and the material is being rapidly converted to oil and natural gas. Diamonds are thought to be millions of years old, but scientists regularly discover the presence of C14 in diamonds. And again, C14 should be completely undetectable in anything thought to be older than 50 to 100,000 years old based on the current decay rate of carbon-14. So apparently, diamonds aren't as old as scientists have long thought. Apparently, something happened within the last few thousand years that sped up the decay rate of carbon-14 over a period of time, again, aging things rapidly initially, and not enough time has since passed to allow for the complete decay of the C14 within. So diamonds are thousands, not millions of years old. Number 14, again, if the earth is relatively young, we'd predict evidence that would be uncovered that indicates the layers of the geologic column can form, can be deposited and then lithify rapidly. And so the sediment can be deposited and lithified. And we found just one example from polystrate fossils, fossils that cut across multiple rock layers, multiple strata, like, for example, this tree or this tree. I mean, if those layers that these trees have been petrified in take millions of years to accumulate and then lithify, you'd have to argue that this tree was sticking up out of the ground with its roots covered up and dead and lithified for eons while gradually the rest of it gets piled up in order to... I mean, is that something that happens? Is that something we see happen to trees today? No. Trees, they fall down and decay, and you're not going to see them still around. So if you see a polystrate fossil, that indicates you've got a catastrophic event that deposited all that sediment around it in some kind of rapid way and kept it from scavengers and the sort of processes that will cause decay in order for this to be able to fossilize. Trees, calamites, catfish have been found as polystrate fossils. This is probably the most famous, an 80-foot-long baleen whale that was fossilized, found in a diatomaceous earth quarry in California. So just one example of a polystrate fossil refutes the claim that sediments take millions of years to lithify. And again, when you think about catastrophic plate tectonics and the rapid deposition of sediment that's going on during the flood, it makes sense of the bulk of the fossil record. Number 15, secular geologists argue that uniformitarianism is true, although there is some movement away from that. But evolutionary dating techniques are all based on the assumption of uniformitarianism. And those techniques are the primary evidence that are used to prove the Earth is old. And I cover that more in depth in my Age of the Earth seminar. But according to uniformitarianism, processes going on today have always been going on in essentially the same way throughout time. And so if a stream is going through a canyon and slowly removing its sediment, then uniformitarianism assumes it's always done that in the same slow way. But if the creation model is true, we'd predict that canyons can form rapidly from catastrophic events like flooding, and evidence substantiates that prediction. For example, March 19, 1982, a small eruption at the summit of Mount St. Helens caused a massive mud flow. Within one day, 20-mile-long, 140-foot-deep canyon was carved, shown here on the screen. This completely nullifies uniformitarianism. If uniformitarianism is true, it should have taken tens, if not hundreds of thousands, for the little stream that's going through this canyon to gradually erode this. It's been called the Little Grand Canyon. It appears to be a 1/40th scale model of the Grand Canyon. The Lake Missoula flood I mentioned as being from the Ice Age. Water breached an ice dam and 500 cubic miles of water was released. It's 10 times the combined flow of all the rivers in the world. Released in 2 days, it destroyed 16,000 square miles of terrain, cut hundreds of feet through solid rock, creating canyons, carving 50 cubic miles of earth. I could give several other examples of that. Number 16, if the earth is relatively young, but evolutionary dating techniques say it's old, we predict that evidence would come forth indicating evolutionary dating techniques must have some flawed assumptions. And that evidence is becoming more and more readily available. Radiometric absolute dating techniques are built on at least three fundamental assumptions that have major problems when you go get actual experimental evidence. And each of these can be shown to be unreasonable. The book, The Young Earth, that we sell, it's not an AP book, but it is the book put out by the Institute for Creation Research, does a great job of highlighting a lot of that. But they show a lot of the evidence of the claim that these assumptions are bad. But for the sake of time, let's look briefly at some recent news which highlights why that first assumption is wrong, and that is that the nuclear decay rates of the parent elements as they decay down into the daughter elements over time, the assumption is that nuclear decay rate has been constant throughout time. In 2009, though, the European Organization for Nuclear Research, this is where the Large Hadron Collider is that discovered the Higgs boson particle, they announced research that indicates the nuclear decay rates are not, in fact, always constant. In fact, they found that if you have ultrasonic cavitation in water, the decay rate of thorium-228 increased by a factor of 10,000. Okay, that's pretty significant. First of all, that's exactly the kind of conditions we'd expect in the flood. And what that means is that rocks that are dated as being hundreds of millions of years old are actually not that old. You had a lot of decay in a short amount of time if you have certain conditions that speed up the decay rates. In 2010, a team at Purdue did some research that was released that discovered that radioactive decay rates apparently vary with the sun's rotation, the way that the inner workings of the sun work, the movement of the sun and so forth. So notice, without this foundational assumption of constant nuclear decay rates, the radiometric dating techniques cannot be used to get the age of anything very old with any certainty. And therefore, the primary evidence of an old Earth disappears. And again, the creation model predicted the decay rates are not constant, and science is confirming that. Number 17, if the Bible indicates the Earth is relatively young, the creation model would predict that evidence of that claim would surface, and it has. Many different lines of evidence point to a young Earth. For example, the moon is receding from the Earth at a rate of about 4 centimeters per year at present, but the recession is not linear. So when it was closer to the Earth, the recession would have been faster. But based on the equation that describes this recession rate, scientists can calculate where the moon would have been compared to the Earth at different times in history. So we know, for example, that 6,000 years ago, the moon would have been about 800 feet closer to the Earth than it is today, and that wouldn't be a problem. But it would be a problem if the moon is as old as they say it is. So evolutionists claim the moon is 4.5 billion years old, but 1.5 billion years ago, the moon would have actually been touching the Earth. So it would be physically impossible to be older than that. So they would have to try to explain that by claiming, well, the recession rate must have been different in the past, but now they're giving up on uniformitarianism. But the uniformitarian assumption is what they use to give them the old ages they need for evolution. So without the uniformitarian assumption, the evidence for an old age of the Earth vanishes. So bottom line, the moon cannot be as old as they claim. A 6,000 to 8,000 year old moon, as predicted by the creation model, fits comfortably with the evidence. One other area, in the area of population statistics, evolutionists believe humans have been on the Earth for some 2 to 3 million years. So using statistical equations, you can get an estimate of how many people should be on the Earth if that were true. So given conservative estimates accounting for disease, war, famine, and so forth, and also assuming that humans have only been on the Earth for 1 million rather than 2 to 3 million years, there should be 10 to the 2,000th power people on Earth today. And most of us have no idea what in the world that number is. So try to grasp that. Consider that the known universe is 28 billion light years in diameter. So if you were to take miniature humans, 3 feet tall with narrow shoulders, and squeeze them into the universe like sardines, you could squeeze 10 to the 82nd power people in the whole universe. Now notice that leaves a few more people. A ridiculous number of people. In fact, enough to completely pack 10 to the 1,918 other universes like ours, to completely fill that many more universes. And remember, those are calculations based on humans being around just 1 million years, not 2 to 3 million, as evolutionists suppose. So if it's argued, well, there just couldn't be that many people, there'd be a lack of resources, and so all those extra people would just die off somewhere around 50 million people, which is what they say the Earth's capacity would be, resource-wise. Okay, then there should be evidence that that capacity was reached long ago many times, and therefore there should be billions upon billions of hominid fossils proving that contention. But there simply is no such evidence that the Earth's human population has ever been anywhere near capacity. And in fact, they'll come out and admit the evidence of human evolution, even finding any kind of ancient hominid fossils, it's rare, it's scant. In fact, I've got one quote where they say, there's not even enough to basically fill up one coffin with fossils. It's just not reasonable, the mathematical gymnastics that have to be done to try to make this work. Now, interestingly, if you adjust your calculation based on the creation model and what we would predict, we'd argue that about 4,350 years ago, 6 people began the repopulation of the Earth, if you take out Noah and his wife. And therefore, there should be about 6.7 to 8.1 billion people on the planet today, which is, of course, very close to what you actually see. Another example, scientists have been measuring the Earth's magnetic field with precision since 1835. They've determined that the Earth's magnetic field is decaying, and it even has a half-life of 1,100 years. And so again, if we assume uniformitarianism like they do, and we calculate back in time and we double the Earth's magnetic field intensity every 1,100 years, you get to a point 30,000 years ago when the Earth's magnetic field would have been so intense that it would have that the Earth's field would have been comparable to that of a neutron star. It would have created immense heat that would have been catastrophic to the Earth. Earth's internal structure likely couldn't have even sustained the immense heat. It'd be impossible for life to even be able to exist 30,000 years ago, and yet evolutionists say life has been around not 30,000 years, but 3.8 billion years. So if the Earth is as young as we would claim, again, there's no problem to dodge. So I've got several other techniques that I've written in a 2019 Reason and Revelation article that you can see on our website, and you can go look there for more. But for the sake of time, we're going to go ahead and move forward. Number 18, evolution predicts that life has evolved into more complex forms, and intelligence has gradually increased over time, starting with a single-celled organism and ending with the state of consciousness that humans enjoy. Ancient man is depicted as dumb cavemen grunting and beating things with clubs, incapable of intelligent thought. And yes, I know we are heading back in that direction, I acknowledge. But anyway, they were only developing more sophisticated technology as their brains evolved enough to allow him to. The creation model would actually predict the opposite, that God made man fully formed and perfect. His brain, his mental ability, his genes were in pristine condition without any genetic defect and mutation. His ability to think and reason no doubt exceeded our own. So man before the flood could have been capable of amazing engineering feats, especially when you keep in mind humans are living for hundreds of years. So imagine what you could do with the craft you've learned over decades if you expanded that by hundreds of years. How amazing would you be in whatever your craft is? The Bible verifies that humans were already intelligent at the beginning, indicating that cities were being built by the time of Adam's grandson. And apparently during the lifetime of Adam, men are already using tents, having livestock, designing and using musical instruments, even working with bronze and iron. So we're talking steel. So this is in Genesis chapter 4. These are practices thought to have taken hundreds of thousands of years to develop. So the evolutionary model would predict something more like an increase in human advancement and intelligence and enlightenment as we evolve. But we would predict that advancement doesn't really have to do with intellect or intelligence. Entropy plays a major role. So as the human genome continues to degenerate over time, our bodies and brains are simply not capable of doing what they would have been able to do 6,000 years ago. So we would predict a gradual decline in many aspects of humanity. But also, number two, we'd predict human advancement has to do with the state of a society, like the decisions that its leaders make, whether the society creates an atmosphere that encourages learning and research and exploration, how free a society is to exercise its God-given talents. Because remember, the Creator made us to be free. And of course, whether or not that society is behaving in a way that'll grant it providential blessings from God, those are going to be important factors in the state of any society. So advancement would be up and down at different levels throughout history. And of course, when a society collapses, you'd expect much of the advancement to just come to a complete halt, many times totally disappear. And the Bible will even make passing references to these nations that get totally obliterated and they become just a byword. And so sure enough, the more archaeologists dig around, the more amazing things are discovered that prove the great intelligence of an ancient man. They found amazing architectural structures that many times are still a mystery as to how they were even able to create these at the time they were made. Archaeologists have uncovered evidence of advanced ancient human intelligence from all over the world, ancient boats able to hold many people, precise maps, advanced astronomy, even though they didn't have the tools that we have today, advanced chemistry, hydraulic engineering, and weaponry. Solid evidence indicates that the Nazgan people of Peru flourished flourishing between 100 BC and 800 AD, were able to perform successful skull surgery to relieve pressure on the brain from battle wounds, even though, again, all this technology disappears, and then the civilizations that are living in the same areas where evidence is found will oftentimes be third world country civilizations that don't have any of the abilities that clearly the people did before them, but they're totally unaware of what the people from that area were able to do. The Noscan people were able to build a sophisticated system of aqueducts, many of which are still functioning today, 2,000 years later, called Puquios. So ancient towers, ziggurats, pyramids have been found all over the world, some in many cases thousands of years old, abilities which societies had, and then the technology disappeared with the collapse of that society, only to be uncovered by archaeologists hundreds or thousands of years later. The Nazgûn people, again flourishing some 2,000 years ago, were able to draw these enormous, precise pictures on the ground called geoglyphs, that span miles. These are so enormous that many of them weren't even discovered until we could fly over them. They're actually featured on the fourth Indiana Jones movie. So these lines are actually roads. In the 1930s, archaeologists discovered ancient batteries, proving that people in Baghdad knew how to make these as early as 250 BC. In 2006, the New York Times ran a piece announcing the discovery of ancient Peruvian canals used for irrigation farming. They're thought to be 4,000 to 5,000 years old, so going all the way back beyond even the time of Abraham, possibly. Craig Morris of the American Museum of Natural History said their use of slope and management of water flow shows again that ancient people were a lot smarter and more observant than we often give them credit for. Humans have always been intelligent, and again, the creation model would predict that that would have always been the case, even in ancient times. Now, it's true that we have a lot of advanced technology today, and that can be confusing to you if you don't understand what's really going on there. It doesn't mean that humans have gotten smarter. The primary discoveries, if you think about it, that have caused the amazing technological progress we have today that sets us apart from any known history in the past. So learning how to harness electricity, telephones, the internal combustion engine, airplanes, computers, they can be traced back, generally speaking, to individuals who either accidentally stumbled across a discovery or designed something after many, many trials and errors, again, and ultimately stumbled across it. So it wasn't about humans being more evolved. Now, after something is discovered, something important, humans are really good at building on that discovery and doing a lot of other things with it. We can invent things. And we have more people on the planet today. And since we figured out better ways to communicate, those people can communicate more than has been possible in the past. And so that allows progress to happen quickly. But the primary key discoveries themselves that allow all that are oftentimes lucky breaks, or as we would say it, providential blessings. So if you imagine the pre-flood world, if they had stumbled across, say, electricity, you know, who knows what they would have been capable of doing and building on that knowledge when you think about how long they lived. I've thought before it'd be cool if we land on Mars and we find evidence that the pre-flood humans had already been there or something. Don't quote me on that, but... Number 19, since the Bible mentions giant humans, we predict there might be evidence surfaced that supports that claim. Are giants a mythical idea? Apparently not, according to evolutionists. The popular science podcast, The Naked Scientists, yes, that's what it's called, put out by Cambridge University, they conducted an interview with Lee Berger in 2007. Lee Berger is the paleoanthropologist of the University of Witwatersrand in South Africa. He's been on the news a lot because he discovered some of the biggest fossil finds over the last decade, Australopithecus sediba and Homo naledi. So the group had an opportunity to visit the fossil collection he has at the university where he's a professor, and they discussed the fossils of the museum. So in the article following the interview, Chris Smith, who's the editor, he said, one of the most interesting things that the fossil record reveals is that we went through a period of extreme giantism. These were people routinely over 7 feet tall. They were huge. So Lee Berger said, you've probably heard the myth that ancient humans were tiny, and some of them were tiny, but as we move through the period of 0.5 million to 300,000 years ago, this is actually really post-flood, pre-Abraham is what this would mean, they go through a period of giantism. He then proceeded to show the group an example of the giant femurs from a species dubbed Homo heidelbergensis. Berger says they are huge. That's so big we can't even calculate how big this individual was. You'd need an NBA basketball player to get someone of the height someone like this would have been, something like over 7 feet tall. So these are enormous fossils. They don't even know how large these guys would have been. He just surmises over 7 feet tall. So Smith responds and says, okay, is this extreme size? Could this have just been a quirk, like some kind of abnormality among humans? And Berger says, no, because we found a lot of them. Everywhere we find them enormous. These are what we call archaic Homo sapiens. Some people refer to them as Homo heidelbergensis. These individuals are extraordinary. They are giants. All right, so notice, first of all, he acknowledges that they're human. They're Homo sapiens, but they're ancient, so they're just found deeper in the rock strata, but they're big. They're giant-like, and it's not just some kind of weird abnormality. There seems to have been a race of these individuals. And if Homo heidelbergensis isn't big enough for you, back in 1944, Rolf von Koenigswalde of the Netherlands Indies Geological Survey found some enormous jaw bones. Time magazine ran an article announcing the discovery. Notice the title, Giants in Those Days, quoting from Genesis 6. Koenigswalde first found a big jawbone which looked more human than Pithecanthropus's, but was so massive that he thought it could not possibly be a man's. Then he found a still larger jaw, the biggest ever discovered, which was unmistakably human, he said. So Time magazine ran this article. Notice he says, it was apparently the most primitive, truly human fossil ever discovered. Koenigswalde named it Meganthropus paleojavanicus. That's a mouthful. And that wasn't the end. Koenigswalde's crowning find dwarfed even Meganthropus. He found three astounding teeth. They were six times as big as a modern man's molars. Weidenreich is sure from the pattern of their biting surfaces that they are definitely human. He has named this man monster Gigantanthropus. Weidenreich now believes that gigantism and massiveness may have been a general or at least widespread character of early mankind. So it's possible these aren't all references to the giants of the Bible. I would hypothesize that the ancient world, especially the pre-flood environment, may have been more conducive to a larger size all around for humanity on average, not just larger for animals and plants, but in a widespread more way, humans as well, as he is suggesting. So maybe, maybe not, but notice again, we have scientific evidence that verifies the Bible's predictions and helps to substantiate the creation model. And if the fossil evidence isn't enough, we can look around today and see examples of extremely large people, even though we're thousands of years beyond the optimal period of human health and life longevity. When you think of giants, I think of the professional wrestler Andre the Giant, 1993. He was just 7 feet 4 inches, which is pretty tall, but short compared to the tallest man alive today, Sultan Kosin, who is 8 feet 3 inches tall. His immense height seems to have come as a result of a pituitary condition that resulted in an overproduction of growth hormones. So notice we even know how you can become that big. According to the Guinness Book of World Records, the tallest man in medical history that has been reliably confirmed was Robert Vodlow, who died in 1940, measuring in at 8 feet 11 inches. We're talking 9 feet tall. Weighed in at 491 pounds at one point. So the giants of the Bible were not mythical beings. They're real humans, albeit big ones. Number 20, if the flood happened, we'd predict that stories from such a cataclysmic event would surely be preserved as ancient oral traditions or in writings, since the flood would have been before the time when possibly writing was even occurring. Maybe, maybe not. The stories could have been initially passed down by word of mouth, at least in a period of time after the flood. And so we'd expect similarities between stories, but you would expect them not to be exactly the same, and likely many distortions would have been made over the millennia. Well, sure enough, there's over 250 distinct legends about a great flood that are in virtually every society of the world. Here's just a few. From Greece, Zeus wanted to destroy humans with a flood and start over. So Deucalion and his wife were put in a large wooden chest, and a flood came that covered almost all of the mountain peaks. In Babylon, Utnapishtim is warned by a god to build a boat in preparation for a terrible flood. He covers it with pitch. He brings animals of all kinds and provisions. He sends out a dove to see if the flood had receded, then a swallow, then a raven, which didn't return. And then they left the boat and worshiped their gods. Notice some pretty stunning similarities there. The Toltec Indians tell of a great flood that destroyed the first world 1,716 years after creation, very close to the timeline depicted there in Genesis 5. A few people then escaped in a closed chest. In China, you have the Nasu. God sent a messenger to tell three sons of a flood. Dumb listened, ironically, and built a wooden boat. And then a huge flood came that covered the whole earth. Dumb was saved and had three sons that then repopulated the earth. So amazing similarities. They don't match the biblical model perfectly. But again, if they did match, you'd think there'd been some kind of collusion. People got together and kind of got their story straight. In the books, the discovery of Genesis and Genesis and the mystery Confucius couldn't solve. Nelson even argues that the origin for the Chinese word for boat is actually comprised of the ancient forms of the words for vessel, eight, and mouth, or people. And Nelson makes a case for several other Chinese words being traced back to the flood and even to the Tower of Babel and even creation, and also argues from historical evidence that the Chinese were originally monotheistic, which is what you'd expect every culture to have originally been whenever they start at the Tower of Babel. So again, over 250 legends of a major flood, and the resemblances to Scripture is notable, and just as we would predict to be the case if the flood happened. In light of the catastrophic nature of the flood, as well as the drastic change in lifespans after the flood, we'd predict that during and after the flood, for a period of time, there'd probably be evidence of irregular rates for geologic processes, for example, that today are constant and slow, like nuclear decay rates, tectonic plate movement, tree ring growth, ice layer formation, and so forth. And a lot of that we might cover. I think some of that we'll cover tomorrow. The rest of it we'll have to maybe cover, just have to read the book. So let's move on to number 22. We're going to be short on time here. So evidence that catastrophism, so rapid burial from catastrophes rather than uniformitarianism, explains much of the geologic column, especially the fossils. We would predict that that kind of information would be uncovered. And we already saw some examples of polystrate fossils, but you also have dinosaur graveyards that are all over the world, including these that I was actually did dinosaur excavation in up in Wyoming, where there's some 5,000 dinosaurs that are represented in this single ranch up there in Wyoming. Over 20,000 dinosaur fossils have been excavated there. This is a fossil showing evidence of rapid burial. Notice this fish is in the middle of his dinner when it gets killed and buried by something catastrophic. This ichthyosaur is in the middle of giving birth whenever it gets hit by some kind of major catastrophe. These dinosaur fossils show a typical posture that dinosaur fossils are found in if they're articulated. So if you have, usually when you find dinosaur fossils, you find them isolated. You don't find the entire skeleton all together. It's torn apart in pieces. In fact, up in Wyoming, they're shredded. We're finding T-Rex and Triceratops, these enormous creatures whose bones have been torn into little pieces. They're just shredded all over the place. But if you find them articulated, many times you find them in this posture with their heads thrown back. A lot of times their mouth is open like they're gasping for air. Their tails are coming forward. And this is called it's a death pose called the epistatonic death posture. And it's under, and they're found in sedimentary rock thought to be deposited by water. And again, this is understood to be due to death by water catastrophe, exactly what we'd predict. All right, numbers 23 through 26 concern the fossil record. We would predict that the fossil record will reveal fully functional, distinct creatures when they first appear in the fossil record. We'd predict that it'll reflect the progression of the flood. We'd predict there to be strange fossil anomalies that don't fit evolutionary thinking, we predict many fossil graveyards will be found. So number 23, when fossils appear, they should be fully functional with no evolutionary history. This prediction has been verified beyond a doubt in the fossil record and even conceded by the secular community. It's one of the three big characteristics of the fossil record that the paleontologists will acknowledge, and that is abrupt appearance. Abrupt appearance of animals without any evolutionary history. They're already fully formed and functional. So when you look at the base of the geologic column, below the Cambrian strata, there's hardly any kind of fossils at all. Then all of a sudden, when you get to the Cambrian strata, all you find across the entire planet this explosion of fully formed fossils, very diverse. They're not simple. There's complexity and simplicity all mixed across the whole planet. And you can imagine what we would say that is that's actually going on there. But it's called the Cambrian explosion by evolutionists. Notice what Richard Dawkins says about it. The Cambrian strata of rocks, vintage about 600 million years, are the oldest in which we find most of the major invertebrate groups. And we find many of them already in an advanced state of evolution the very first time they appear. It's as though they were just planted there without any evolutionary history. Needless to say, this appearance of sudden planting has delighted creationists, well, sure, because it verifies our prediction. It's exactly what we predict to be the case, and the fossil record is shouting this to be the case. They have to do some serious gymnastics to try to get out of that one. Numbers 24 through 25, evolutionary theory would predict that the fossils in the lowest strata should be simple, closer to that single-celled organism that they would say everything came from. Trilobites are considered representative of those first strata. And then as you move higher in the column, the fossils should, from an evolutionary perspective, become more complex as life supposedly evolves towards human beings. Well, when you look at the actual evidence, you find out the trilobite, here it is, supposed to be representative of the earliest strata, and it's not simple. It's considered one of the first creatures to show up, and yet it's complex. The eye of the trilobite is equipped with an aplanatic lens, dual lenses, as opposed to the human eye, which is equipped with a single refractive lens. Scientists acknowledge the design of the trilobite is even better than any other eye design, and yet again, it's supposed to be primitive and simple. The trilobite is evidence against evolution. It's exactly what we'd predict to be the case if creation is true. We're short on time, so oh, this one, you got a mammal with a dinosaur in its stomach. That's not supposed to be there. How about the existence of so-called living fossils like the coelacanth? Right? So they find these in the fossil record, supposedly millions of years ago. And then they think they go extinct. And then all of a sudden, we find living coelacanths in the oceans. That's going to be a problem for the evolutionary model. And notice they haven't evolved. They're acknowledged to be the same structurally. So the evolutionary model struggles with anomalies that contradict the predictions of evolution, but they're actually predicted by the creation model. The main way we would explain the fossil record is when the flood begins, as we explained in that previous session. So it's starting in the oceans. The first thing you would expect to get killed and buried are ocean floor dwelling creatures. That's the first thing you see. The next thing you would expect are the fish. And then as the flood progresses towards the coast, you're going to start seeing coastal creatures and then creatures like the dinosaurs and the larger reptiles that are just further inland. So it's showing it's a record of the flood. And by the way, the fish, after they show up, they then continue through the rest of the layers, even in the middle of continents. It's exactly what you'd expect if the flood caused it. Flood caused basically the entire fossil record, at least between the Paleozoic and Mesozoic layers. The Cenozoic is considered post-flood. Concerning number 26, fossil graveyards are clear examples of places where herds of animals were caught and unable to escape a cataclysmic fossil-forming event, and these are found all over the world. I've already showed you the one I studied in Wyoming. All right, almost out of time here. Sedimentary rock is understood by geologists to be formed in bodies of water. If the flood happened, we'd expect sedimentary rocks would be prevalent on the earth, especially in the flood layers, and they are. They're the most common rocks exposed on the surface of the earth. They make up 75% of the surface rocks, even on mountains. Number 28, seismites, we'd predict they would be found if the flood and specifically catastrophic plate tectonics is true, seismites are layers of sediment that are known to form during earthquakes, layers of sediment that are underwater and they're shaken by earthquakes and they leave behind little volcanoes as the sediment settles where the water is trying to get up out of the sediment. These are called fluid avulsion structures. And when that layer then lithifies, it turns to stone, it's known as a seismite. So major earthquakes today are known to create small seismites on the order of inches thick. Well, in 2014 and 2016, I had the opportunity to hunt for seismites with creation paleontologists up in Wyoming. And these are not inches thick. These are 15 feet or more thick. This is proof of large amounts of water, Wyoming being totally underwater, proof of enormous, never heard of earthquakes. This is where the dinosaurs are being killed. You even find dinosaur fossils sticking out of some of these seismites. So based on catastrophic plate tectonics, these are probably the quakes that occurred when the Pacific Ocean plate is smashing into the West Coast at the end of the flood, forming the mountain ranges in the West like your Rocky Mountains. Numbers 29 and 30, if the creation model is true and the incident of the Tower of Babel is true, we'd expect there to be evidence of that event through, for example, stories being passed down through the millennia, as with the flood and as we find with dinosaur tales that have been passed down as well. Recall the flood legend of the Toltec Indians and the legend after the survivors left the chest, they wandered the earth until they found a place to build a zaqali, a high tower, in case another flood came. And then during that time period, their languages were confused and they spread out over the earth. The Miao Tzu people of China have a flood legend where it poured for 40 days and then there were 55 days of drizzle and the flood covered the mountain ranges. Nuwa and his family and animals were saved in a wide boat, and then the bird was sent out, sacrifices are made. The survivors made cities, spoke the same language, built a very high tower, which was wrong. God came and mixed the languages, and then they didn't finish the city and tower, and they separated over the earth. Dan Landis documents other examples. In the Burmese legend, the people build a pagoda to try to reach the heavens, and their god comes down and angrily confuses their languages and causes them to spread out. In the Congo, instead of building a tower, the people balance themselves on poles. In the Mexican version, they build a tower out of clay. In India, it was demons, and they build an altar to the sky and are thwarted by the sky god. Africa, Greece, the Assam people, many people have a story about this structure being built into the sky and the languages being confused so that the people have to spread out. And as with the flood legends, the details don't match perfectly, and they wouldn't be expected to match, since the traditions were passed down likely orally for centuries. And if they did match, you'd expect there'd been some kind of collusion. But the common thread of an incident involving God, a tall structure, the confusion of languages is a common theme that would be predicted based on the flood model. And we'll cover number 30, our last prediction, in our lesson tomorrow morning. So the creation model, you know, it's unscientific. You can't make any verifiable predictions. So you guys are wasting your time being here. Thank you for your attention.